Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Richard Higgs, the co-host of Public Radio Tulsa's Folk Salad, who has admittedly been a drifter, a hitchhiker, a migrant farm worker, a soldier, a fugitive, a prisoner, a long-haul trucker, and a mountain climber in the course of his life. His memoir, Then There Is No Mountain, is ostensibly about a road trip across the West to try to climb Mount Rainier after a bout with cancer. It actually details a life of a rootless man searching for the roots he would eventually find here in Tulsa. Higgs has been the co-host of Folk Salad since the show's inception in 1999 and is the author of a previous memoir, Bringing in the Sheaves, which chronicled the summer he spent working on a wheat harvest crew from Texas up to the Dakotas. He's also contributed to Oklahoma Today magazine, The Current, and This Land Press. Then There Is No Mountain, An American Memoir, is his new book, and he'll be signing it tonight at 7 o'clock at Dwelling Spaces at 119 South Detroit Avenue. Richard Higgs is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Richard Higgs, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Rich. Thanks for having me in. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it is a great pleasure to have you. Of course, you're co-host of Folk Salad, but we're here today to talk about your memoir, Then There Is No Mountain, An American Memoir, which really struck me as a person trying to find out what roots him to the earth. Because as we learn here, I knew that you'd worked on a wheat harvest and you'd done some unusual jobs early in your life. But I really didn't know that you were like a traveler, if you will, pretty rootless.
Yeah, I became restless early on, you know, and I think it's kind of the classic young male thing, you know, leaving the nest. And I hit the road pretty early, and I traveled quite a bit over the years throughout America.
This would have been like the early 70s, so it strikes me, you know, you would have been a person in the 1930s that hit the rails.
Yeah.
You think?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, basically, you put out a thumb or rode a bus and basically would go to a new town, find some sort of menial job, and just sort of learn about the place.
Yes, that's right. I've always, you know, loved this country we live in, and I've always wanted to get out there and play in it. It's been my playground, I guess you could say, yeah. And as far as sticking out your thumb, you know, in those days, you could do that. Those were the times, you know, the late 60s into the early 70s, when that was actually kind of a viable means of travel for a young person, you know, and I got a lot of miles out of that thumb.
So what was the impetus for writing the book?
Well, it actually started out as an attempt at a magazine article, actually. Because my buddy Joe Dennis, had been pestering me for a couple of years to go climb. He started out wanting to climb Denali, you know, like, you know, he had some great ambitions there. And every time I'd see him, he'd bring up the subject of Denali, you know, and, you know, what we'd have to do to prepare to climb Denali, how much it would cost, how much of a time thing. And I was steadfastly, no, can't do it. I'm too old. I'm too poor. I'm too pressed for time. Can't do it.
And it's 20,000 feet.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah, one of the highest mountains, you know, well, the highest mountain in North America, you know. But so that went on for probably almost a year. And finally, he got the message like, no, I'm never climbing Denali. And it kind of settled down a little bit. And our conversations and our walks around town became, kind of went back to their normal flow of just everything under the sun.
Now, you sort of climbed some mountains with him, right?
Yeah, we had done some climbing in New Mexico and Arizona. So, you know, we had a little bit of background there, but he had ambitions. But anyway, after he finally settled down and stopped bringing up Denali in every conversation for several weeks, everything was okay, you know. And then one day we were hiking up in the Tallgrass Prairie, and he says, Rainier. And it started all over again. And I had the same answer, no. But then something happened in my life that caused me to realize it was time to stop saying no and time to start saying yes. So we climbed Mount Rainier. And the adventure we took was a three-week road trip throughout the American West. You know, all these great cities and all that great American landscape and a great American road trip punctuated by a mountain climb. It was just so inherently literary. It sort of really wanted to be told, you know. And so I thought, well, this would be a great magazine article for, like, Outside Magazine. You know, a couple of middle-aged Oaky Flatlanders, how they train and prepare and go climb Mount Rainier and have this great American road trip. So when we got back, I got busy, and I wrote it up, and I got a really nice article all prepared, except it had one fatal flaw, which was it was 75 pages long. You know? Now, what do you do with a 75-page manuscript? You know, it's way too long to be a magazine article, and it's way too short to be a book. So it's exactly the wrong length for anything. So
what you do in the story is basically you tell this road trip, but it's interspersed with your entire life. You grew up in Richmond, Indiana, mm-hmm. which is famous as one of the first recording meccas in the United States. It was the home of the Gannett Piano Company.
That's right, yeah.
And this will be where all the Chicago musicians from the 1920s would come to record at Richmond, Indiana. That's where you grew up. And you were aware of that, right?
Yeah. In fact, as I was growing up there, the local public library had a really nice collection of those old recordings there. And so I'd go up to the library. You know, this is back in the days when it was old hard vinyl, you know.
And it'd be 78s probably.
Yeah, 78s. And you go in the little listening room. And it was a way to educate yourself, not only about the local history and the importance, you know, of the Gannett recordings, but it was also just a good way to learn just the overall arching view of the history of American music kind of through that lens.
It's kind of interesting that that's where you started out and now you're doing a show like Folks Hour.
Yeah.
But go ahead. So Richmond, Indiana was home, but
yeah.
But you left home, what, right after high school? Or maybe tooling around, maybe thinking about going to college and not, and maybe attending for a little bit, and mm-hmm. and then just hitting the road.
Yeah, I spent a couple of years there after high school trying to figure things out, you know, which is pretty common, I think. And ultimately, I ended up joining the Air Force. I had flirted with the idea of going to college a couple of times and didn't really quite work out, you know, for various reasons. So I joined the Air Force, and this was in 72. Spent a couple of years in there.
Well, that's one of the funniest scenes of the book, because you joined the Air Force. You know, this is Vietnam still.
Right.
So this is the safe branch.
Yeah, right, right. Hey, maybe I'd get to fly in an airplane. Who knows?
Yeah, and so you're a dental technician, right?
Right,
You're medical training.
Mm-hmm.
And you go AWOL.
Yeah.
And then the question everybody asked was, why did you go AWOL?
I know, yeah. It's like nobody could quite believe it. In fact, in the Air Force, at least at the base where I was, when they dragged me back in, they didn't have any place to put me. They didn't even have a brig. You know, it was like, what do we do with this guy? You know, it's like, we don't even have it. They had a little drunk tank for guys who had been pulled in for dinner. They stuck me in there, but I was in everybody's way. They finally had to just tuck me away.
And it was basically, I think you tell the story of going from brig to brig on the way back to, was it North Carolina, somewhere in there? Where were you stationed? I forget. Virginia.
Virginia, yeah.
Yeah. And
that's right.
You're being there with other armed forces. It's just, you're in the Air Force? You went AWOL?
Yeah, right. Yeah, nobody could believe it. Yeah. Well, you know, those were dark times inside me, to be honest with you. There was a lot of kind of anguish inside. It had nothing to do with where I was. It was just a matter of who I was inside.
You know? It was interesting, and it was fun to read.
Yeah.
The thing that struck me is, so how did this road trip become sort of a meditation on your whole life?
Well, as I mentioned, it came out, the magazine article, quote unquote, came out to 75 pages. And so I had to either shorten it or lengthen it. And I couldn't bring myself to shorten it. And so I realized that as we made this big loop through the American West, we kept crossing old pathways of mine. And so those became the kind of jumping off points for anecdotes and stories from past adventures. And so it sort of organically grew from that.
Now, we mentioned at the very top that your previous book was about doing a wheat harvest. You went from what, Texas all the way up to near the Canadian border?
Near the Canadian border, yeah.
Yeah. So those old memories were dredged up?
A few, yeah.
I mean, you've already written about it once, so.
Yeah, that didn't play into it too much. For that reason, I've already written that. But also, we were kind of going across the grain, so to speak. I mean, this was an east-west travel. And one of the things that I remembered when we were working the wheat harvest was feeling that we were cutting across kind of the grain of travel. We were going from south to north instead of the classic American east-west flow. Mm-hmm. So as we went through this trip, we really didn't have too much of an intersection with that previous trip. Mm-hmm. Although in western Kansas, we crossed through some of the old towns I had gone through.
Now, you were also a long-haul truck driver. I never knew that.
Oh, yeah. I did that for a couple of years. Yeah.
Somebody who's done that for a few years, does that make travel a different experience for you?
Well, it was a different way to travel, of course. I feel like that over-the-road truckers, they get a view of America that nobody else has, you know, because they, especially if you're the kind I was where you're going all over the place, you don't have a set route, and you're basically a pinball machine, and it's on a continental scale. And so you really get a feel for the lay of the land. You know where the bridges are that cross the Mississippi. You know where the mountain passes are. You know what color the Blue Mountains really are. that sort of thing. You really get to understand. Well, I look at it this way. When we say America, it can mean many different things. You know, it's a political system. It's a history. It's a culture. It's you name it. There are many different ways, many different things that word means. But the one meaning of America, I think, that underlies all those others is America, what I call America the physical, the land itself.
The road atlas.
Yeah. You know, and it's still out there, and it's just as beautiful and wonderful as it ever was. And so that's what you get to know if you're paying attention as an over-the-road trucker, the physical layout of America.
There's a portion where you go through Vegas and your companion, one of your companions is like, no, we cannot go here. And you know, the evil incarnate of Las Vegas. You say, you know, I've been there at least once or maybe more as a trucker, says, but I never knew the town because I just went to a warehouse, turned around, slept for an hour and got out of town.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that's kind of an interesting way to experience life. You see the trip, but you never see the destination.
Well, that's right, yeah. And another thing, too, about trucking is it can make you a little weird after a while because you spend all of your time, or at least I did, either completely alone or in the company of strangers that you'll never see again. And I found that after a year or so, it made me kind of wary around people. It really started changing me, and that's when I started to realize, you know, I really ought to get off the road. And
well, that's so. One thing that comes out of this memoir is you pick up friends pretty quick, and there are a numerous from a hitchhiker that sort of becomes your companion for a while until you're pretty trusting and open person as far as meeting new people and just sort of becoming a part of the landscape. This is something that shows up in a lot of your travels. It's like all of a sudden you moved to a new place and all of a sudden you've got a new circle of friends very quickly.
Yeah, that's true. That may come from the way I grew up, too. You know, we, as a child with my siblings and I, we moved around a lot. We were in the same general area, you know, kind of around the Richmond, Indiana area, but we always lived in the country or in some of the smaller towns, little satellite towns around there in the farm country up there. So every year or two, we were, as children, we were going to a new school and making new friends. So that's sort of been a pattern in my life from the beginning.
Yeah. My guest today is Richard Higgs. He's the co-host of Public Radio Tulsa's Folk Salad, and he's a writer, written for numerous publications, and his latest book is a memoir, Then There Is No Mountain, an American memoir. He'll be signing it tonight at 7 o'clock at Dwelling Spaces in downtown Tulsa at 119 South Detroit, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, tell us about the preparation for Rainier. You know, you talk about Denali being out of reach, but really, Rainier and Denali are similar in a lot of ways because you're basically going from near sea level to 14,000 feet in the case of Rainier and then 20 in the case of Denali, as opposed to a Rocky Mountains mountain where the base is 8,000, you're climbing about 4,000 or 5,000 feet. You're climbing about what?
Well, we went,
10,000 more feet?
Yeah, from where we were camped, I mean, where we were, our base station was there at Whitaker, it was probably less than 1,000 feet above sea level, you know, 400 or 500 feet. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you're really, of course, the climb itself starts at about 6,000 and you work up from there. So, and the thing about Rainier, too, is it's a steep mountain because it's volcanic. So it's essentially a cone. And you're not just taking this high elevation hike, you're climbing. You know, now, we didn't have to use ropes or anything, although we were roped together, you know, after a certain point. But, and also it's cold. And steep. So it's cold and steep, and it's a tough mountain. They say it's the toughest mountain in the lower 48, and believe me, I believe it.
So you prepared. You prepared for how many months? And of course, you mentioned there was an event, and you mentioned in the book, you had cancer.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Sort of an aggressive prostate cancer.
Yes, that's right. I was diagnosed in spring of 2008, and I had the surgery scheduled for about 2.5 months later, I think in early August. So during that time, of course, I had a lot of time to think. And so that's when it came to me that, yeah, I need to say yes to Joe. Let's go climb this mountain.
So then you began preparing?
Yeah, as much as you can in Tulsa. You know, we did what we could. We started out, you know, working out really hard in the gym, you know, just to get hardened up. But eventually we let go of the gym and just went out to Chandler Park. And that's where we did most of our preparation. And the rhythm I established, there's a really steep climb out there from down at street level, down by the river, up to the top of Chandler Park. It's a couple hundred feet.
Yeah.
And I started out with like a 30-pound pack, and I would do like 5 laps, you know, up and down the pack. And once that got easy, I would add 5 pounds and then work my way back up to 5 or 6 laps. Once that got easy, add more. I ended up with about a 45 to 50-pound pack doing about 6 laps twice a week out there just to get hardened up and get into the climbing. But you can't really prepare for the altitude, you know, mm-hmm. the oxygen loss. There's no way you can prepare for that.
And even going out there and acclimating along the way, it just...
It helps, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything helps, but that's all you can do. The only way you can get used to the altitude is get in the altitude. Yeah.
So you go to Rainier, you eventually start climbing. What was the feeling like?
Well, it was tough. It is the toughest thing I have ever done physically. It was extremely hard.
Now, this is from a person who's, what, climbed 13 or 14s down in New Mexico? Or
12s and 13s.
12s and 13s, yeah.
And yeah, so it was tough because like in New Mexico, basically what you have is a high elevation hike. You know, I mean, you're up in a high grounds, but you're not climbing steep so much. You just walk on these kind of hogback ridges and you work your way up and work your way up. This was unrelentingly steep and cold, and you had a heavy pack on you because it was an overnight climb, and a big heavy parka because it's very cold up there. This was in June, right around the solstice, and it was still very cold up on that mountain.
Mm. Yeah. My guest today is Richard Higgs. His new memoir is titled Then There Is No Mountain, an American Memoir. You mentioned as this started out to be a road trip, and it sort of grew out of proportion writing-wise. Mm-hmm. Talk about the process of, you know, sort of revisiting your past. Is this something you've written about often, or is this the first attempt to write about your past? Can you talk about that process of just sort of mining your experiences?
Sure, yeah. Basically what it is I was just telling stories that I've always told to family and friends, you know, the stories I've always liked telling, mm-hmm. and people always seem to like hearing. And so it started just, you know, I would cross, like for just to give an example, in Wyoming, we stopped at a town there on the way out to Rainier to have lunch. And I remembered that was a town where I had met a woman to go back east with, who I had previously met in Wyoming, up by Jackson Hole. And so it triggered that memory, and I had told that story of the summer that followed that. And so it just grew from that. As we passed these old places where I had memories from, I would remember an anecdote. And so I would start writing that down, and then it would lead to another and lead to another. But I always wanted to bring it back to the what I guess you could call the armature of the story, which is the, you know, the main thread of our climb. So there would be these departures into my past, and then I would bring it back to the main storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was just telling this, stories from my adventures that I've always told, and not in any particular order either. There's nothing really chronological about this memoir. It just goes where it wants to go. I tried to keep it pretty organic.
Yeah. Give us a sense of how... I mean, it seems like everywhere you went, you had lived there or you'd passed through or spent some time there.
Well,
were you traveling for a good number of years or it seemed, you know, because it seems like, you know, you moved out west, then you would come back to Indiana, then you'd move. I think at one point you were squatting in a plantation house that had been abandoned.
Yes, Nashville. Yeah, it happens that, I think this is back in 70, probably 73, I happened to be on the run from the law, and I ran into a guy, you know, who also had a need to disappear, and so we decided we would disappear because I could feel it getting, I don't know why, but I could feel them getting closer. I was getting edgier and edgier, so we decided that we would tell everybody we knew that we were going to Denver, Colorado. We're going to hitchhike to Denver, see the mountains. And instead, we took off for Tampa, Florida. And we didn't make it to either place. We ended up, much to our surprise, in Nashville. And we were penniless and kind of on the run. So we found this old abandoned plantation house out in the outskirts of Nashville. And we squatted there for a while. And then one day, he disappeared. And I spent about a week there by myself. And finally, one day, the owner came in and told me that people had been seeing smoke from his chimney for the first time in a long time.
This has been a house that had been, what, abandoned for years?
Decades, possibly. I mean, it was long, long abandoned, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so he said, basically, get off.
Yeah, you know, you got to go. He had actually, I had been in town that day in Nashville, and when I came home, all my stuff was gone. So it was just me and what I had on my back. And I was standing there trying to figure out what to do, and he comes bouncing down the lane there in his big Cadillac, and course, I knew who it was immediately. I mean, it was just pretty obvious. So we had a little meeting there on the porch. It was cordial, you know. He was an okay guy. And I said, "You're going to give me my stuff back?" And he said, "Yeah, but you can't stay here." So that was the end of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ended up sleeping under the Dedrick Street Bridge that night.
And that's something that's really surprising about you. You've always been able to find a place, you know, even homelessness doesn't seem to affect you as far as what you write about.
Yeah, you know, I don't even know if the word homeless had been coined yet back then. I didn't really think of myself as homeless.
I think of the book as sort of a person searching for roots. And you know, I mean, you're kind of rooted here in Tulsa now.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And that's sort of the takeaway is this. You've found a place here that you can call home. Although you also write that it's very common for you to just take off and go, say, out to... the Candy Creek or Candy River?
Yeah, you know, just north of town, yeah.
Yeah, just kind of go off and camp by yourself. And that's sort of you kind of have a wanderer's mentality. But it seems like this book is sort of a search for roots from a person who's essentially rootless or has been rootless.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment, I think. But, you know, when I hit Tulsa, bang, I got rooted right away. I moved here in January of 1980, and I've lived here ever since. And, you know, I absolutely love this city. I always have. From day one, you know, it felt right. It was a place I'd never been to that already felt familiar from the first day.
And this is from somebody who's lived in, San Francisco? You lived in a lot of places, different places for a short amount of time.
Yeah, passing through a lot of places, that's for sure, yeah. But Tulsa felt like home right away, and it has proven to be so, yeah.
Yeah. The name of the book is Then There Is No Mountain, an American memoir by Richard Higgs, my guest today. He is the co-host of Folk Salad, and you guys just celebrated your 14th anniversary on the show, and it'll be 15 this coming year.
That's right, 15 years.
Nobody said it would last.
I know.
what's it like doing the show? I mean, one of the things you guys do is you interview an awful lot of musicians on the show.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the rhythm. We like to do, out of four shows, you know, maybe once a month we'll pull an interview in. If you average it out, I mean, it's real pretty free form. We love doing the show. One of the things, the incentive for starting the show was that there is such a rich music heritage and current scene in not just Tulsa, but in Oklahoma. And yet you'd never know it by listening to the radio. So we thought, well, you know, let's stop complaining about it and let's have a radio show. And thank goodness you said yes.
Yeah, well, that was a number of years ago. And of course, now you're on several stations in the state. And you really are tapping into that whole Red Dirt movement and singer-songwriter movement. And I think it's been a great, great help to a lot of these musicians. And it's also been a focal point for a lot of them as far as, you know, people hearing each other, of getting the word out about what's going on. And that's a really important service, I think.
Well, yeah, we really try to serve the community. We really do. As you say, mentioning upcoming events, getting guys in to help promote their new album, or whatever it takes. And one of the things that's always been really important to us is not to, like, ghettoize the local scene. You know, we blend our playlists in where we'll have maybe the Paul Benjamin Band write with a Steve Earle song, that kind of thing. National and local all blended together because, believe me, they can stand on their own. I mean, they don't have to be partitioned off, you know, to some separate little show. And that's real important to us to acknowledge that.
And you, the show is very much involved in bringing showcases, really. I mean, it's kind of interesting that we have our own little showcase scene here in Tulsa.
Yeah, it's true, yeah. Especially Scott. He's been really good at doing house concerts. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're both, you know, we're hooked into that nationwide scene, and he's doing house concerts now a couple of times a month. He's been doing them for several years, and that has really been a great success. And that's mostly due to Scott's efforts, I must say. But we also do some MC work around town with the All Soul Coffee House series and some shows that have been going on down at the Tulsa Little Theater, and, of course, the great scene at the Guthrie Green as well.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great success with Then There Is No Mountain. I want to ask you, you know, you bring all these memories, you put them down on paper. What's your takeaway from all the work and all the hard work of writing and creating a readable narrative? But obviously, anytime somebody writes a memoir, there should be some reflection, or you would think there would be some reflection. What's your takeaway?
That's an interesting question, and to be honest with you, I can't say that I learned a lot about myself from writing this book. What I learned a lot about was the art of writing, and it's funny. My mother asked me, "Why did you write this book?" you know, and I had to confront that question explicitly for the first time. And when I thought about it, you know, I didn't really write this book because I discovered this source of the Nile or anything like that. I mean, I've had some adventures, but I wrote this book honestly because I wanted to practice the art of writing. I love writing, and my own life happens to be a convenient source of stories to write about.
Mm-hmm. You know, the story of climbing Rainier is, should we tell them what happens on Rainier?
Let's not.
Okay. All right. Well, there's an unfortunate incident the night before the climb.
Oh that, yes.
And we'll leave it at that, and you can read the book and decide what happens. But
it did have a serious effect on the climb, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess my sense is this is not a memoir of great discovery. It's just more a telling of a life.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was wondering if you had had any personal reflections and understanding from retelling that story of a life, which was, you know, you had a lot of events in your life, but you know what I'm saying? It's not usually the subject we see a memoir about other than just to tell your life story.
Yeah. I wanted to, one of my goals, I think, was to speak for other people of my generation. I wanted to kind of capture the tenor of not only our youth, which hopefully I did with enough cultural touch points in there, but also how we've come along in our maturity, so to speak, you know, and what it's like now. And hopefully I did that. Some of the responses I've got, I seem to have hit a nerve with a lot of people who go, yes, that feels right. That's similar to my experience.
You came of age, what, about 69, 70?
Came of age, well, I turned 18 in 1970.
Right.
Yeah.
That was a crazy time.
Oh, I know. It really was, yeah. A lot of times kids will ask me, you know, it's like, what was it like back then? And I can't help saying, you know, well, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And, you know, it kind of was.
Yeah, it was in many ways. The name of the book is Then There Is No Mountain, American Memoir. Richard Higgs will be signing the book tonight at 7 o'clock at Dwelling Spaces at 119 South Detroit. And, of course, you can hear him every Sunday at 7 on Folk Salad here on Public Radio Tulsa. Richard, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me in. It was a real pleasure.
Richard Higgs is the author of Then There Is No Mountain, an American Memoir. He's also the co-host of Public Radio Tulsa's Folk Salad and a local writer. He'll be signing the book tonight at 7 o'clock at Dwelling Spaces at 119 South Detroit Avenue. Let's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. The caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain. Snow will be a blinding sight to see as it lies.